Good afternoon. I'm opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today is March 13th, 2017. The public hearing is on House Bill 5013, the Judicial Department. And while they're coming forward, Mr. Bender, you want to kind of...
Yeah.
And I know that the Chief Justice is here, and I'm sure Ms. Glick is going to be is here. Ms. Glick, what? How many sessions have you been helping with the presentation?
For the record, Kingsley Glick, State Court Administrator. I was thinking it depends on if you're counting special sessions.
Yes, counting special sessions.
I'll have to go back and count because there were some years there were like 3 to 5 of them. But hearing since 1985 in various capacities.
I was thinking when I was looking out that you have been here with us for chronologically advantage of time.
Right.
That means for those of us who have been around for some time and have a lot of experience, knowledge, and wisdom. How is that?
Wisdom, yeah, especially.
Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Subcommittee members. Today is the first of 4 days scheduled for the Judicial Department budget, Phase 1 budget hearings. The Judicial Department operates the state's unified court system and is headed by the Chief Justice, who is here to testify today. Just to put some context for this budget before you, before the they begin their testimony, the state is spending approximately $725 million on the judicial branch this biennium. And those funds are almost entirely split between two agencies of the judicial branch. The first is the Judicial Department, who's before you today. They operate the court system, and they spend approximately 60% of the $725 million. The other 40% is spent on indigent defense in criminal cases, a program which is operated by the Public Defense Services Commission. They will be before you, I believe, in about 2 weeks. They're coming before you with their budget. So there's basically a 60-40 split between those two agencies. I did mention that public defense, indigent defense, is for criminal cases. Since I mentioned that, I would like to say that there is some support that the state provides to indigent persons for civil cases through the legal aid program. That support is funded through the Judicial Department's budget, though they do not operate that program directly. They in statute, the Oregon State Bar operates that program, and they transfer funds to that program of about $11.9 million. The request before you, the Judicial Department is coming before you with a request that is about 10% above expenditures during the current biennium. So they're requesting to spend, and I'm speaking general fund here. I'll go to other funds briefly later. But their general fund request is about 10% above the current biennium. This is about a 4% increase over the current service level. The remaining 6% is the growth in expenditures that are included in the current service level calculation. In the Judicial Department also has other funds in its budget. During the current biennium, those other funds amount to $148 million, so it's a large amount of other funds. The proceeds, or what these other funds consists of, though, is quite interesting. The largest component is bond proceeds that the state issues and county matching funds required under the program that is funding courthouse construction projects at various counties. So the bond proceeds and the county match forms the largest portion of the agency's other funds. But there are also other funds that the agency spends from other sources. One of those is that the courts are permitted in the budget to retain a limited amount of their filing fees and, well, basically their filing fees. The courts collect a lot of filing fees for people who are bringing cases before them, and also collect fines for people who are convicted of offenses. Generally speaking, these are not retained by the courts, but are transferred either to the general fund, criminal fine account, or other entities such as cities and counties in instances. However, you have allowed OJD to retain some limited funds that they collect. These include filing fees that are transferred to support the legal aid program that I mentioned. They also include a certain proportion of filing fees, a little less than 5%, which are retained by OJD and then restricted to the use of supporting technology systems. And there are also some fees for services, limited fees for services that the courts charge, primarily for access to the e-court system, which you'll be hearing about, and for paying for filing and other charges that are related to that. Also, OJD receives money that the legislature allocates to them from the criminal fine account. So some of these funds were collected by courts, transferred to the criminal fine account, and then reallocated back to the agency. Again, the situation that the courts are facing, their primary workload, which would be caseload levels, have been declining for some time now. And in the past 4 years, if you look at the last four-year period, caseloads at the circuit court level, excluding parking violations, which are processed somewhat differently, are down about 12.5% over the last 4 years at the circuit court level and at the court of appeals level. The Supreme Court's workload is also down, but by less, by about 4.6%. Again, this is just looking at caseloads and not the types of caseloads. Basically, all categories of cases are declining, broad categories of cases, over this particular period, except felonies, which felony cases are quite expensive for the courts in that they require allocation of a lot of time and resources. You will also see the impact of the increase in felonies on the public defense budget, which will come before you in 2 weeks. There's a much more direct relationship between caseloads and the costs, because for public defense, we provide service, we provide contractors compensation directly based on their caseloads, whereas for the court system, the costs are not directly related by caseloads. They just, caseloads obviously have an impact. Nonetheless, the courts have, there have been significant reductions in employment in the courts in the last recession. So the reduction in caseloads has certainly helped courts manage the reduction in their employment count that they've had to take. And you can see there are a number of issues that have resulted from those reductions in employee count that the request before you will be, you'll see they're trying to address specific concerns, primarily due to that reduction in employment count and other needs. So with that, unless there are any questions, I think that sort of sets the stage.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Winters and Co-Chair Winters and Co-Chair Stark. Mr. Bender, thank you for that introduction. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Ballmer. I'm the Chief Justice, and with me is Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator. And she said she admitted to 1985, I think, was when she said she,
in some capacity.
In some capacity, she has been over here. So she's the font of wisdom on these issues. We're going to give you this afternoon, if we can, a brief overview of our budget and what the courts do. We have a 798-page budget document, which I'm sure everybody has scrutinized as carefully as I have. And any questions, we can refer them to other people. But it is an important document. It's important. We understand why the legislature wants that kind of information. We've provided it. But it's also important to talk in a way that we can understand the issues that are out there, the challenges that are facing the courts. And so we'll talk today a little bit about the overview. We'll talk about some of the priorities in the Chief Justice's recommended budget. And tomorrow you'll hear from David Moon and John Fagan of our Business and Fiscal Services Division. And they can talk in more detail about the budget structure, resources, collections, and the reductions that we were asked to address in our budget presentation. On Wednesday, we'll hear more about our POPs and some of the proposals that that we hope you'll look favorably upon. We think that we can do a better job serving the people of this state. We'd like to have a chance to do that. We'll talk about some of the details of some of the grants that we get. We do get some grants coming in from outside sources, that money that we spend. And I think Lane Shetterly from the Oregon Law Commission will probably briefly appear on Wednesday. The small amount that the legislature appropriates to the Oregon Law Commission actually comes through the Judicial Department budget, too. And then on Thursday, there will be some public testimony. So the three branches of government, just to sort of get us all on the same page, are Civics 101. I wouldn't raise this issue except for I was in the well of the or on the podium in the House one time when a Speaker of the House, who I will not mention, referred to the three branches of government as the Senate, the House, and the Executive. Right. And behind him were sitting 15 judges in black robes. So to redress that imbalance, we put the Judicial Department, the judicial branch, here in the middle, even though we probably belong off to the side somewhere. As Mr. Bender mentioned, the Office of Public Defense Services is also considered part of the judicial branch, even though it is not under the control of me or Ms. Click. And the Commission on Judicial Fitness also is part of the judicial branch, but also is independent of the Judicial Department. And it's the Judicial Department that we're here to talk about today. Our mission statement, and I know some members of the committee have heard this presentation in the past, so I'll try and talk fast. For some of you, this may be new information. But basically, just to remind us what we're trying to do here, the judicial branch is a separate and independent branch of government, but our mission is to provide fair and accessible justice services. We try to protect the rights of individuals, preserve community welfare, and inspire public confidence. To accomplish that mission, we have identified five long-term goals: access to the courts, trust and confidence. We have to earn and keep the public's trust and confidence. You know how difficult that job can be at times. It's difficult for all of government, and it's no different for the courts. We want to help people choose the best way to resolve their disputes. Sometimes that's a mediation. Sometimes, as you well know, in family dissolution cases, it may be better to resolve things without having lawyers going hammer and tong at each other. Other times, it may be appropriate to have a full jury trial or a trial before a court. We try to help people find the best way to resolve their disputes. We need to, in order to be successful, build strong partnerships with our local communities, with law enforcement, with churches, with civic groups, with the counties that provide health and other kinds of services. And administration, Kingsley and I work, Ms. Click and I work every day to try and administer the court system as well as we can, to use the dollars that you appropriate wisely, and to be good stewards of your money, to look for cost-effective ways to perform the functions that we are asked by statute and by the Constitution to perform. What do we do? We take this from Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, my favorite provision. The framers of the Oregon Constitution in 1857, went into effect in 1859, said that we were to provide justice completely. The courts were to be open and to provide justice completely and without delay. And that's what we try and do. We try to be open and accessible and to reach results that work for all of Oregon's residents. The courts are at the core of the critical path to preserving a whole lot of things that we want to preserve. And I think what's interesting is courts are really one of the core functions of government. You need a legislature. You need some sort of court system. Every society, small or informal, no matter how big or sophisticated, needs some sort of court system to do two things, in my view. To make sure to enforce the rules that we've agreed to live by, that's the criminal law, and to peacefully resolve disputes. And that's mostly the civil law and other things. And that's essentially what we do. So the courts themselves usually aren't in the news, but what goes on in the courts often is in the news. And if you watch the news, read the paper, watch the news at night, the number of times the courts come up, not as having caused the news, but because there is somebody being arraigned, there's a trial, there is a big medical malpractice case, there is a business dispute, there are children who are in the public welfare system. All of these issues in our society, many of them, move through the courts. So from crimes and violations, as this chart shows, in order to get to resolutions, to get to restitution for victims, to sentences or fines, you go through the courts. Children at risk, if children are at risk of abuse or neglect, those have to go through the courts. DHS can't simply come in and take children away. This all has to be approved by the court, and what happens has to be approved by the courts. These are very difficult cases, as you know. If families can be reunified, if we end up in foster care, if we move towards adoption, those things go through the courts. Civil and economic disputes, from small claims between neighbors and trees that are chopped down when they're not supposed to be, or dogs who were run over, these end up in the courts. Landlord-tenant matters end up in the courts. Large business disputes end up in the courts, and it's from those disputes and the movement to judgments for money damages, an injunction against a polluter, all sorts of things like that end up in the courts, and that's how we move from the issues that society faces to results that will protect rights and allow obligations to be enforced. And we could have chosen a whole bunch of other examples, but we also included here abuse and domestic relations. We end up with many, many requests for restraining orders and family disputes of all kinds, potentially violent ones and even peaceful ones. But all, when I do marriages, I say, this is a contract. This is a special contract. You can't get out of this just because you want to get out of it. You have to go to court to get out of it. And we do a lot of that. That's one of the areas where we're trying to find better ways of resolving marriages that aren't working and dealing with custody and child care and things like that. Many Oregonians who've never been to the state capitol, never talked to their legislator, have been in court. That's where people go to pay their fines. They may be a witness. They may be a juror. And we are, in many ways, the front line of government for a lot of members of our society. You asked us as part of the budget instruction to talk about the drivers and environmental factors that affect our budget. The interesting thing about the courts is we don't go out looking for work. You bring us the work. When you pass a law that gives certain rights, that will lead to court cases oftentimes. When the people propose a ballot measure, an initiative, and if that passes, that may give people certain rights, and those often end up in litigation. Think about the land use laws that we have now, which are very comprehensive, been on the books since 1970, creates all sorts of rights. When you change the workers' comp statutes or the insurance code, those are issues that can come to court. When you change the statute of limitations for people suing for sex abuse and suing a church or the Boy Scouts or somebody else, that brings cases to the courts. There are all sorts of things that the federal government, the federal Supreme Court, can decide a case, and suddenly we've got a whole bunch more cases of a particular kind. So there are many things that drive our workload and therefore our budget. Demographic factors are very important in this regard. Crime rates go down. The number of felonies and misdemeanors we're asked to handle go down. Employment and economic health affect our workload. And one of the drivers, I think, of the decline in civil cases in the last few years has been the economy slowly getting better. And there seem to be fewer mortgage foreclosures. There are fewer credit card debt collection cases. And these things go up and down, at least somewhat, with the economy. Demographic factors, numbers of children, family, the health of families. When families are in dysfunction, if a parent is incarcerated or there's drug abuse within the family, that can drive our juvenile function. And we end up with a lot more cases trying to deal with kids from families that are not working out for them. And federal and state revenue and funding can change cases. Change the amount of work we have. Workload drivers, case complexity is an important driver of this. It's one thing to prosecute someone who's stolen a purse or burgled a home, if you can catch them. They didn't catch the last person to burgle my home, but they tried. It is another thing to prosecute someone who's engaged in identity theft. And it has an operation in their garage where they're producing credit cards and going into people's bank accounts and somehow taking over people's identities and using that to steal from other people. Increases in the number of self-represented parties has been a very big challenge over the last 20 years. The sort of paradigm case that we thought about in law school, where you had a lawyer on one side and a lawyer on the other and a trial before a judge, that's not what happens in state court most of the time. In many, many cases these days, certainly in most family law disputes and in most small claims cases, in many landlord-tenant cases and other debt collection cases, there may be attorney on one side or both sides may be self-represented. That presents special challenges for judges and staff that we're trying to deal with. Increases in treatment court services. We're going to talk about treatment courts a little later. These are the drug courts, the veterans courts, the mental health courts that you may have heard about, which we are using, and often with great success, to reduce recidivism, keep people in the community while holding them accountable for crimes they may have committed. But it's a very intensive effort, and it requires a lot of judge time and a lot of staff time, both from the courts and from communities and alcohol or drug service addiction services, and saves money on the correction side, probably saves society down the road, but costs some money up front. And finally, just to mention one other category of budget drivers, our criminal justice partners, if there are additional police officers, that means more arrests, that usually means more prosecutions. If there are additional district attorneys, deputy district attorneys, that increases the number of cases that we deal with. When there's jail space available, that's a factor. There are a number of other issues that are mentioned here, including substance abuse and mental health services at the local level, which is an ongoing challenge. The courts interact with virtually every state agency, probably more than any other agency that's going to come before you or probably before any of the Ways and Means subcommittees. We interact every day with the DAs, with the State Department of Justice, with OSP, with the Department of Corrections, the Department of Revenue, Human Resources, Health Authority, Youth Authority. Those are all factors in how much work we have. They're the people that we have to respond to, and we are committed to doing this work, but it's not always easy, and it takes a substantial amount of resources. My budget priorities, and we're going to address these in more detail down the road, but just so you have these in mind, obviously, I want to keep the courts open every business day, and I want to have the staff to drive fair and timely resolution of the cases that we have before us. That means judges, that means support staff, that means the technology and physical infrastructure that we need to run the courts. Thanks to you folks, we have been able to do this for the last couple years. 5 years ago, our courts were closed on many Fridays for at least in 2011, 12, 13, I think. As the economy has gotten a little better, the legislature has helped us keep the courts open every day, and that's been very important. If somebody needs a restraining order on Friday, or one of our tech companies needs to try and get an injunction against some employees who've jumped ship to another company, they need to go in on Friday. You can't wait until Monday, oftentimes, and that's why it's been very important for us to be able to do that. Now, that said, we have not, and Mr. Bender alluded to this, we have not returned to the staff level that we were at in 2008, and we have had no new judges in the last 10 years, so we face some challenges there. So keeping the courts open every day with the support we need is my first priority. E-Court, as we'll talk about in a little bit, we have just completed implementation of our statewide E-Court electronic court project. This is a $93 million project that we brought in on time and on budget and completed by rolling out to the Eastern courts. That was our last group at the end of June of 2016. And then there was sort of wrap-up for the project by the end of 2016. Now we need to use this facility that we have to drive better outcomes, to provide greater consistency across the state, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But we need to figure out how to get funding to do that. This is a system that has to be maintained. We have to do training. We have to do updates as they come along. And it's a very exciting system, and we want to make as full a use of it as we can. My second priority is to move judicial compensation to the median of the 13 Western states. We are, when adjusted for cost of living in different states, our trial judges are now getting paid 48 out of 51 jurisdictions in the country. And we're way below the median in the 13 Western states, which was the recommendation of the Public Officials Compensation Commission when it met last in 2008. We have made some progress. You folks have helped us. We have a cost of living mechanism now in statute, and that has been very important in keeping some of our judges on the bench when they might well have decided to retire and become arbitrators or something like that. But we'll talk about that later. We do want to move judicial compensation towards that median of the 13 Western states. We'll also talk later, and let me just mention it now. The Multnomah County Courthouse is the biggest, the busiest courthouse in the state. And the state has generously stepped up with a matching bond program to help replace dangerous and inadequate courthouse facilities across the state. Representative Hussman was there in Madras when we dedicated the new Jefferson County Courthouse last year. We also dedicated a new courthouse in LeGrand, Union County, and we had the groundbreaking for the Multnomah County Courthouse in September. That is requiring a big lift from the state through bond funds and from Multnomah County. We also have some other courts that are looking at new courthouses, Lane, Hood River, and Clackamas down the road. So that is this is a work in progress. As I mentioned, we've not had new judges in 10 years. And we did a study. The National Center for State Courts came in and said, you need 30 new judges. Well, we knew that wasn't going to fly. So I'm asking for 10. I don't want to bid against myself, but if I could get 3, I'd be very happy. I am bidding against myself. We could use some new judicial resources, and we'll talk about that later. And then finally, we ask for some additional staff for the specialty courts that I mentioned, the treatment courts, and for help in dealing with self-represented people. Our ongoing challenges, as I mentioned, we're below the 2008 staff levels. As Mr. Bender said, the cases have decreased a little bit. The workload has increased because the mix of cases has changed. As Mr. Bender noted, felonies are up. The complexity of the cases are up. The number of self-represented litigants is up. Need some additional folks to meet our obligation of delivering timely court services. I think most of these sort of identify in another way things that I've already mentioned. E-court, statewide consistency, retaining our judges, courthouse facilities. We're doing a lot on case disposition time and backlogs. We have a number of initiatives to try and get courts to use best practices around the state. We have a unified court system, but it is decentralized. And for historical reasons, different courts, we have 27 judicial districts, we have courts in all 36 counties, and some of them do things very differently. We're trying to get them to do things to preserve local culture. We don't want to eradicate local culture. But when there are more efficient ways of doing things that don't compromise local culture or fairness of results, we want people to do those. That's my own challenges as Chief Justice dealing with 173 independently elected judges. And we want to continue helping the self-represented litigants and addressing the workload shifts and the changes that are made in the laws every session and the changes that are coming through technology. Briefly, and again, this is old hat for, I know, for Senator Winters and for some of the others, but talk just very briefly about our court structure, because this may be new to...
Chief Justice, I did not like the reference old.
Chronologically...
advantaged. Okay. That's the term she likes.
But we don't say chronologically challenged. That's right. We say chronologically advantaged. As someone now eligible for Medicare, let me give you 1 minute of history, if I might. We think of ourselves, and this is because we're not at the center of the whole thing, we think of ourselves as being the oldest organ of Oregon government. Because the courts, we go back before statehood, we go back before Oregon was a territory, we go back to 1841. And what happened in 1841 is the largest landowner in the state, a guy named Ewing Young, died without a will. So the settlers in this area said, well, we need a judge, because that's what you do when you have somebody who died without a will. You divide it by the law, the state by the law of intestate succession. And so they elected one of their members, not a lawyer, but a doctor, Senator Steiner Hayward, a doctor named Ira Babcock. And they said, Dr. Babcock, you are now Judge Babcock, and they called him Chief Judge with Probate Powers. And they said, you divide up the estate of Ewing Young. And they happened to have the law book of the state of New York that had the probate code. And so they said, you use this law of New York to divide up his assets. And he did. And we trace our origins as a court system to Judge Babcock, Dr. Babcock, in 1841. And even before Oregon became a territory, there were cases decided, there were jury trials, there were appeals under the provisional government, and Oregon judges were elected and paid. And then under the territory, when Oregon was a territory beginning in 1848, the federal government ran the whole show, and judges were appointed by the president. And then in 1859, when Oregon finally became a state, that's when the Oregon state court system was created. And it looked sort of like this. There was a Supreme Court, and there were circuit courts Although in those days, at least in the very beginning, the circuit judges also sat on the Supreme Court. But what our current system really, and I'll end the historical digression there, began in 1983. The 1981 legislature was very farsighted, and we all owe a debt of gratitude to them for coming up with what is really a very thoughtfully put together unified court system. At that time, prior to 1983, the counties essentially ran the trial courts. The judges were state officials, but they were in county courthouses. The counties paid all the employees and provided the operations for the trial courts. And the state had the Supreme Court and, beginning in 1969, Oregon Court of Appeals. And in 1983, the legislature, in 81, the legislature proposed that it happened in 83, and they consolidated the Oregon courts into a unified state-funded system. And we took over, the state took over all those employees. Counties were still supposed to provide the courthouses, but all the employees became state employees. And that is the current modern system. We now have a Supreme Court with 7 members, Court of Appeals with 13 judges. They usually sit in panels of 3. And then we have the tax court with 1 judge. And then we have circuit courts in all counties and in 27 judicial districts. Most of our judicial districts have 1 county, but once you move to the next slide there, you'll see a number of them, including the 7th, for example, has 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 counties. Coos and Curry are together in 1 judicial district, but for the most part, we have 1 county and 1 judicial district. The Supreme Court is the court of last resort, and the 7 of us, select one of our members to be the Chief Justice. We generally have discretionary review of the Court of Appeals decisions. So this is like the U.S. Supreme Court, right? The Court of Appeals, if you don't like what happened to you in the trial court, you appeal to the Court of Appeals. They have to take your case. If you don't like what happened in the Court of Appeals, you can ask the Supreme Court to take your case. But like the U.S. Supreme Court, we don't take every case. We take cases that we think are going to make law in an important issue, on an important issue for the state as a whole, that will guide the legislature or lawyers or police or trial judges around the state. If you simply come to us and say the Court of Appeals got this wrong, we're probably going to say, well, is this really an important case? Can we make law? Would this be helpful to making the law of the state clear? Maybe it's an important statute that was passed and has not been interpreted before. Most of our caseload comes from cases like that. We get 900 or so petitions every year, and we allow maybe 60 or 65 of them. There's certain matters that come directly to the Supreme Court, and this is generally by statute. Legislature decides the cases we have to take directly, death penalty cases, tax court cases, ballot measures, attorney discipline, judge discipline, those sorts of things. And then there's a handful of rarish kinds of cases where people can come directly to the Supreme Court and ask for us to take the case, and we sometimes do. We broadcast all our arguments on the web. We have now with eCourt, we have an electronic brief bank. All our documents are available online. And we go out every year to the communities to have arguments for a day or two around the state. And this fall, we're going to Redmond and Baker City. We go out and hear cases at a high school, have lunch with the local bar. We always invite local representatives if they want to come. And it's a very good way to reach out to communities that don't come to Salem very often.
You don't mind. I have to speak to that. That is one of the most incredible experiences that the students have. They, especially anybody who's been involved with the constitutional law team or that group of folks, they come away from there just excited, and they will sit through the whole arguments and still just be on the edge of their seats. If you get a chance and you can go to any of those presentations with the students, it really is worth it. It's great.
Thank you, Senator Frederick. The Court of Appeals also travels. They only have, since they go on panels of three, it's a little easier logistically for them to go on the road. That's the workhorse of the appellate courts. All appeals from circuit court go to the Court of Appeals. Agency decisions and rules go to the Court of Appeals. Local government decisions, land use decisions that go up through LUBA go to the Court of Appeals. And their filings have gone up and down. This goes back to the drivers. If our court or the U.S. Supreme Court issues a new interpretation of a search and seizure law or something, suddenly you can have a lot of cases at issue that have to apply that new decision. If the legislature passes a new statute or creates a new cause of action, that can lead to increases in the trial court's workload and also the Court of Appeals. The tax court runs very smoothly now. Judge Henry Breithaupt has been there for about 15 years, and he is the tax court judge. He works with several magistrates, and they handle income and often property tax appeals. The circuit courts are our general jurisdiction trial courts. In some courts, these are called superior courts, or they go by different names. In Oregon, for historical reasons, they've been called circuit courts. And as you saw in the judicial district, some of our judges do ride circuit. They go back and forth between Canyon City and Burns, and really are on the circuit. And they hear everything from traffic infractions, hunting and fishing violations, to parking issues, juvenile delinquency, felonies and misdemeanors, families in crisis we've talked about, child support, domestic relations, termination of parental rights, and so on. Now, not all the cases are big cases. Some are very small cases. But if you ever go and sit as a trial judge, and I was not a trial judge in my career. I came right from a law firm to being on the Supreme Court. So I went out and sat as a trial judge to find out what it was like. And you realize that even the really small cases are important to somebody. They're important to the people there. And it's the amounts of money may not be big, and the disputes may seem trivial or tedious, but the people are in court because they have a dispute with somebody else, or it's going to be difficult for them to pay a fine. And we really need this goes back to our request for additional judges and for compensation for judges. We need people who are smart enough to handle this range of cases and compassionate enough to understand what's going on in the lives of the people before them, but can also decide the case based on the fact and the law involved in that particular case. The circuit courts provide timely and appropriate dispute resolution. We try to. Docket management and case management are constant challenges. I mentioned the treatment courts. And we have a number of arbitration and mediation programs to try and right-size the services we provide to the dispute. Not every case requires a two-week trial with lawyers and a 12-person jury, but every case requires a neutral decision-maker, and that's what we try and provide. We try to assist the self-represented people. One of the really important things we do, and I've got to say, going to meetings of the chief justices from around the country, we do very well, is our ADA and language services. We have an excellent interpreter program, and we certify interpreters in a variety of languages. We are very efficient in terms of the way we handle interpreting services, where we can do it on the phone, we can do it in video, we can do it live in the courtroom if that's necessary, and we can do it in dozens of languages. We're very proud of our language services group. I can't remember the actual name of it now. Court Language Access Services. But it's a terrific program of the Oregon judicial branch. We also, our judges in the circuit courts are involved in and often preside over a number of statutory committees. We have criminal justice committees in all the districts. We have family law committees to try and work with the lawyers and interested folks in the community. We have court security and emergency preparedness committees. The courts are one of those institutions that needs to operate when there's an earthquake, when there's a fire, when the electricity goes out. And we have a number of initiatives to try and make sure that we can get the courts back up and running after a natural or man-made emergency. The circuit courts coordinate with our central staff, with me and with Ms. Click, in terms of our legislative outreach and our docket management and access to justice efforts. We have both uniform rules. When we can be uniform, we have supplemental local rules when local practices really are appropriate, and we try and maintain good relationships with the county government agencies because we are within the county courthouses, for example. We work with the district attorneys. We work with community corrections. We work with the local public defenders and legal aid offices, and all that is important. I just have a slide here. I'm not going to go through this, obviously. These are the treatment and specialty courts that we have in our trial courts. And as I mentioned, these are resource-intensive. The ones that have had the most study, I think, and where there are very accepted best practices and evidence-based research shows that working with folks in adult drug court and DUI court can reduce recidivism, keep people out of jail, and nevertheless keep people on a track towards getting rid of the drug or alcohol problem that they had. They can then end up with a charge being dismissed, and that may protect their job. It may keep them out of jail. We think these are a very important part of what we do. We have to have the hammer in order to make this carrot work a little bit. Where we can do it, where we have partners who are willing to work with us in the district attorney's office and public defender office, and there's community support, these are very important to the successful operation of the courts. This case filing chart shows some of the it shows us with civil case load declining a little bit. And we can talk about this at greater length later. You'll see these numbers go up and down. Some of the decline in the civil, if you look up at that top chart, the top column or row, I guess, is due to some changes in the way we categorize cases. In 2016, as I mentioned, we moved towards Odyssey. We've shifted from our old case management system, OGIN, Oregon Judicial Information Network, to Odyssey, which is an OJSON, I think is the name for the information network. But some cases that formerly were categorized as civil are now categorized elsewhere. For example, about 3,000 stalking cases that in prior years were under civil are now show up under other domestic relations. But we don't know exactly why we've had the decline in civil cases that you see here. Partly the economy is better, so there are fewer mortgage foreclosures, fewer debt collection. The legislature mandated mediation of judicial foreclosures, and that took some cases out of the court system. One of the things that's changed over the past 20 or 30 years is tort cases have declined, you know, small automobile accidents. And I think, frankly, the lawyers have sort of priced themselves out of the market on those cases. There are all sorts of reasons for that. Those tort cases have declined nationwide. I haven't studied the Oregon cases. We are now, because of our transition to Odyssey, we're sort of counting apples and oranges here, and it's going to take greater analysis to understand exactly what's going on with the cases. We will have much better information next year because 2017 is the will be the first full year that we're all on Odyssey.
Has a question.
Yes, Mr. Frederick.
Thank you very much. I am looking at the one particular row there that I'm curious about, and that's the mental health. The numbers there seem to have declined over 5 years, and a relatively significant decline. It would be interesting when you do have those that new set of numbers. I'd be interested to find out why that was the case. Thank you.
Yeah, well, Chair Winters and Senator Frederick. Let us see if we can come up with at least a partial answer for you within the next couple days.
Right.
And as you say, and I'm not trying to put this off, but I do think that our 2016 numbers aren't quite, we haven't done all the corrections that we need to do on those, but we will have better information next year, and as we go on, with the Odyssey system, we'll be comparing apples with apples. And we also have just begun to functionalize the report writing system, which is being programmed into Odyssey to allow us to pull these reports automatically, which will be a real improvement in our ability to get the data that we need.
Thank you.
Yes.
When you provide that updated information, could you also sort it by the 36 counties? I think there's probably an interest in seeing, you know, what's occurring with inside of the counties.
May I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Thank
Senator
you.
Steinberg.
Sure. Chief Justice, would you mind going back to that previous slide? Excuse me. As you know, district attorneys and the sheriffs are proposing to change simple possession from of small amounts of controlled substances from a felony to a misdemeanor. Do you have any sense about how that would affect your numbers and your workloads in the circuit court, or is it just really tough to tell until you see what that bill really looks like in its final form, assuming it passes?
I guess I say it sort of it depends.
Okay, that's good enough. I didn't.
We can look at. Let us take a look at those and see if we can break it down a little bit by. We have information by the kind of crime.
Okay.
And so we may be able to tell you at least what the universe of cases that is affected might be.
Yeah, I mean,
which would be sort of half a step in that direction.
35,000 felonies in 2016. It would be helpful to know which ones might be affected. Yeah. Thank you very much, Chief Justice. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Along that line, because they're first timers and nonviolent, and also diverted into treatment rather than, and they're treated as misdemeanors. So it would also be interesting to see the misdemeanor number as well, because what's happening with the two shifts.
They haven't finalized what that will look like.
What
how
that
many
look
if
like?
You get
no
one.
Right.
One or two or three before it's a felony, or none of it's ever a felony,
or
whatever. They're still we're having.
You're still working on the graduation.
Yeah.
Well, Chair Winters, we'll provide you with what we can that sort of relates to that issue.
I think it'd be well to coordinate with the good Representative Barker on that.
We're working on it.
Work in progress.
Yeah.
This pie chart I don't really like very much because it it doesn't represent if you want to look at filings, you'll see Multnomah parking is just a huge amount of our filings, and violations are another large part. But those cases, I pay my parking tickets as soon as I get them because it makes me feel better not to think about them anymore. And I think a lot of other people do, too. Mm-hmm. So they take very little time of court, very little time from a judge. And let's flip to the next slide because this is more useful in terms of understanding where the people in the court spend their time. So you'll see that the light blue, I guess, is the cases filed, and violations in Multnomah parking are very large. That amounts to about 62% of all the cases. But it's only about 4% of the judge's workload and 10% of staff workload. And so you'll see, if you look at the other two bars there, the yellow being the judicial workload and the periwinkle staff workload, you'll see that we really spend most of our time on criminal cases, felonies and misdemeanors, and then about equally civil and domestic relations and protective orders, and with some variation in the amount of staff time and judge time. But that's essentially what we do. Judges, you'll see, also spend a lot of time on juvenile cases, even though they're 13% of total time, even though it's only 1% of our caseload. And that has been a growing amount of the caseload over the past few years. The switching to the other, the non-judge and
can we
court-
go back
sure.
To the juveniles? Are most of them dependency cases?
Yes.
About half and half.
The half and half, Ms. Kingsley forms. Yes.
We need to view the breakout.
Yeah, we'll give you the breakout of that. But yeah, that so this covers both delinquency and dependency. I'm saying about half and half. Okay, the Office of the State Court Administrator, as I mentioned, we do have a unified state court system, and Ms. Click is our State Court Administrator and is really involved in everything that the court does. We provide the State Court Administrator's Office provides central support to the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, and Tax Court here in Salem. We have division managers, and we'll show you the org chart in a minute. We, like other government agencies, we have the whole range of services from HR to IT to business and fiscal services. We also, through the State Court Administrator's Office, administer the Citizens Review Boards, which are involved in foster care review. We administer a juvenile court improvement program that has been very successful in adopting best practices in the juvenile court area, primarily the dependency. We run the certified shorthand reporter program. Importantly, we run the court interpreter program that I mentioned before, and we try and keep OJD as a branch of government and as a government agency in compliance with the many state and federal regulations that we have to deal with. This is the Office of the State Court Administrator's org chart that shows the different functions that I mentioned. In addition to the functions I already mentioned, we have a very robust communication, education, and court management division. We do internal education for our judges, for our employees. We run the judicial conference. We are adopting and implementing some of the wonderful things that we can do with e-court, and I'll mention some of those in a minute. And then we have a legal counsel division because we get sued a lot and have a lot of legal issues we have to deal with. I think that sort of covers it. We also, as you'll see down at the bottom there, in addition to the court language access services, we have a security and emergency preparedness office that works closely with the counties to make sure that we're, our courthouses are secure places for people to go. And also works with us on continuity, business continuity planning.
I didn't see it, but where is your Citizens Review Board?
They're over to the right there, Juvenile and Family Court Programs okay. Divisions. Citizens Review Boards program that, as I said, these are the boards that review foster care placements, and I've gone and sat in with one of those boards, and if anybody's ever done that, that is a very moving experience to hear what's going on in the lives of some of these kids and how much everybody's trying to make sure that we can keep them safe, keep them on a good track, either to you know, reunification or to another placement in a way that's going to make, you know, improve their lives?
We've continued to have some problems and issues with child welfare, as you're aware.
Yeah.
Have you had any inquiry, anyone contacting you with respect to CASA again? Because they're, again, you know, seeking a home?
With regard to CASA, I have not personally had any contact from CASA, and we can respond to you. We'll check with others. Yeah. So the way the courts run is essentially the Chief Justice, by statute, I appoint the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals and the presiding judges of the circuit courts, although there's a sort of a voting process. They get to I get to appoint somebody. If they don't like it, they can vote against that person. I get to appoint somebody again. If they don't like that person, they can reject that person. That usually doesn't happen, but it's a back and forth process with the trial courts and the state court administrator and the presiding judges in the court, Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, and I are essentially by statute in charge of most of the operations of the system. The state court administrator serves as the COO. We have the presiding judges. In each trial court, we have a trial court administrator. That's the top non-judge administrator who manages the day-to-day operations of the circuit court. And then we have a number of judicial of committees. And by statute, there is a judicial conference, which consists of all the judges in the state. The way it looks graphically is this. The Chief Justice and the State Court Administrator get input from all these different groups. I'll mention just a few of them briefly. The presiding judges and trial court administrators you see in the upper left, the Office of the State Court Administrator, those divisions and the division directors that report to Kingsley, the Judicial Conference on the right, which consists of all the judges in the state, again, a creature of statute. Mentioned two other things. We have a group called CREW, Court Reengineering and Efficiencies Work Group. This was created when we had to deal with very significant budget cuts. It was set up in 2010 to sort of review our whole operation. What can we do to do things more efficiently, save money, do things better, cheaper, and what things can we just stop doing? Are there some things like that? And that group is still in effect. After the immediate budget crisis left, we felt that this was an excellent vehicle for vetting proposals for improvements, for getting, and we started out with CREW by soliciting suggestions from everybody, every judge and OJD employee throughout the state. And we got over 1,000 suggestions, which we then whittled down and tried to see which ones. Some of them were great ideas if we'd had a huge amount of money, but that was the whole point. We didn't have any money. So we tried to implement the ones that that we could. And this is a group that has some judges, some presiding judges, some trial court administrators. And, you know, one example of what we've done through CREW recently is to vet proposals for making more consistent our procedures on waiving or deferring fees. As Mr. Bender was saying, there are filing fees, there are various fees you have to pay to file a case in court. If you don't have any money, we can, and we have statutory authority, to defer or waive the fee, but practices have been varied around the state. And we said, shouldn't we be more consistent, more thoughtful about when we waive fees? Because on the one hand, the legislature has said, here's a fee you need to charge. On the other hand, the legislature has said, well, you can waive the fee or defer the fee in certain circumstances. So CREW is the vehicle that we've been using to try and figure out how best to make it consistent across the state and make more rational the way we approach fee waivers and deferrals.
Do you have a sense of how much you a fee waiving that you've done? A dollar amount?
9%. For the record, Kings Click State Court Administrator, co-chair and members of the committee, about 9% of our, of 100% of the fees.
Are waived.
Are waived.
Yeah. And the other option is to defer the fees, and then if they win the case, then maybe they have some, they can get collect the fees from the other side, and we can collect it then. But it's I'm just using that as an example, because I think it's a good one where we wanted input from trial judges and trial court administrators around the state, and on some of these initiatives and proposals that have come through CRU, we've reached out to legal aid or other lawyers that practice in the area and said, what makes sense to you? I'd also mention some OJD committees and work groups, including some that we relate to or would be affected by some of the POPs we have. We have for a long time had a state family law advisory committee, again, broad representation that advises the Chief Justice and the State Court Administrator on family law issues and changes in rules and policies that we ought to be looking at. We have a Staff Education and Professional Development Advisory Committee. We have recently started a Tribal Court State Court Forum, because there are a number of issues where our jurisdiction overlaps with or comes up against or next to tribal court jurisdiction. And this is a forum for communicating about those issues. And we also began last year and chaired by Justice Baldwin, the Oregon Supreme Court Council on Inclusion and Fairness. Representative Sanchez is a member of that. Now she wasn't in the legislature when we asked her to be a member of that council, but as you may know, going back to Chief Justice Peterson in the 1990s, the Oregon courts really had some very thoughtful work done on bias and ethnic bias, racial bias, and fairness in the judicial system, and that was one of the efforts that we never stopped. The effort, but we stopped. We didn't have staff support for the committees that worked on that. Once we got to the budget crisis in 2008-09, and we said we don't have anybody to staff this. We can't afford to have our judges not doing the judge work they need to do. We have now reinstituted that effort, because we really do need to have some organization that shines a light on those issues within the judiciary and helps us with the training we need to do and examine policies that will make sure that this is an open and inclusive system. We're going to follow the facts and the law wherever they lead in any case, but there are also things that we can do in terms of the way we run the courts that will make sure that everybody understands that this is a place where people will be treated fairly and impartially.
Chief Justice,
yes.
This is a very important topic, and particularly and I hope that you're looking both at the juvenile as well as adult systems, because you know some of the work in looking both within the Department of Human Services and foster care, you can find, you know, there that systems needs to be looked at as far as biases and fairness, as well as you can begin to look at movement from young people when they're in that system and how we graduate them into the other systems, OIA and then into DOC. Yeah. So, you know, this issue, I hope as we, you know, go forward with this, and I'm very aware of Judge Peterson when, you know, he began his look and his study.
Right.
So it's nice to know that it's continuing, but I would ask that we begin looking at the front end.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate that reminder. CRU, I talked about that a little bit. We do have a strategic plan. I think there's a copy of it in our 798-page submission. But that identifies the area, the strategic areas and our action items for the four long-term goals that I mentioned at the outset. I think that I've probably touched on almost all of those in my remarks so far. I want to talk just briefly. I know we have a time set, and I don't want to take up every minute of this with my own meandering here. But let me just mention a couple of the governance and strategic initiatives that we're concerned with right now and that are drive some of the requests that we have, including some of our POPs. The courthouse issue, you'll remember that when I said the courts were unified in 1983, the two things the counties were supposed to and did by statute retain control over, they were supposed to provide safe and adequate courthouse facilities and security. As things have transpired over the last 35 years, many counties are unable to repair or replace courthouses that need to be replaced. And the legislature has been very forward looking at this. They've been thinking, they thought about this. Your predecessors did in earlier years. And then we began this matching bond program in 2013. And the picture there is of the new Jefferson County Courthouse in Madras that I mentioned. And we are working with the Capital Construction Committee to make sure that we're addressing the greatest needs first, and the greatest needs of counties that are able to meet the match. This isn't free money. This is the counties have to come up with a plan that passes muster with me, with DAS, and then we work with the counties to get these courthouses constructed well and in a timely way. And I think the Jefferson County Courthouse is a beautiful facility. It's not not overly ostentatious, but it is very it is well done. It is it looks like a place where serious work is done, and I think they've found the right balance between having a handsome, very useful facility that will be in business for the next 50, 60 years, but not spending too much money. And I think the same thing was true of the Union County Courthouse. And as I say, we're working on Multnomah. We also have some for smaller needs. We're focusing on safety and security, ADA. We have helped put in an elevator where there was none. We have helped replace a roof that needed to be replaced. That's one of the ways we're addressing inadequate courthouses. E-Court is our big success story, and I don't want to beat it like a dead horse, but we are very proud of this. You see the list there of our rollout scheduled from June 2012 until June of 2016, when we completed our implementation phase and moved everybody on to this new platform. It provides important services for all our justice partners and for lawyers and self-represented people, and it promotes internal consistency and efficiency within us as a whole, within OJD as a whole. As I said, on schedule, on budget, available statewide now. Now you can pay any traffic ticket, criminal fine, civil fine where the state is collecting it online. Lawyers can file cases online. You can file up until 11:59 on a day. You don't have to get it in by 5 o'clock. And we have now rolled out, and this is probably one of the most exciting things about it for non-lawyers, these guide and file forms. These are interactive forms that allow self-represented people to produce the documents that they need to take their case into court, whether it's residential landlord-tenant cases, small claims, and now family law cases. This is you essentially have a little questionnaire, and this is pitched at a sixth to eighth grade level, and you answer questions. What's your name? What's the name of the person who owes you the money you think is due? what was the date that they started to owe you this money? And you just write, you answer these questions, and it produces a document that will meet the legal requirements. What happens now is people fill out the forms. They might print them offline. They might get them out of a form book, and they handwrite them. So the first step is, or the first good thing is, you can read the handwriting. Because there's not handwriting, it's typed. You can read, so the judge or the staff person can now read what comes in. Plus, the complaint or the legal document now has everything filled out that you need in order to have the case go forward. So you don't have it being sent back by the judge. And this used to happen again and again. People would come in with a form they'd filled out, not sufficient, didn't meet all the requirements, be handed back, they'd come in with another one. So we are very excited about the guide and file I-forms that are now available in the whole class of cases that is shown on the board. And then we also have OJSON, which is our online information, which allows you to see what actions what actions are now pending, the court calendars, get case information and documents. Attorneys, public safety, human services agencies, and many people in the private sector can get documents online. And this has been a very positive development in terms of the people who use the courts. You can file 24/7. We're increasing consistency, and it's making the whole court system more efficient and more effective. We had a survey done of the Oregon State Bar, and 82% of the respondents said they had used Oregon eCourt. Two-thirds said it expanded access to the courts, and 60% said it improved their productivity, and almost half said that it reduced their costs. This shows some of the complexity of eCourt. You'll see Odyssey is the name of the system, and FIAS is the financial aspect of it. OJIN is the information, and you'll see all the different agencies that we have interaction with, from the public and the lawyers to corrections and collection agencies, Department of Revenue, and so on. What's next in eCourt? As I said, implementation is completed, but it's like owning a house. You need to maintain it. You need to keep it up. And the POP that we will talk about tomorrow or Wednesday, we'll talk about what we need to do to eCourt to make sure that we have enough money to keep the system up to date, to train new people, and to use some of the capabilities that the system has to improve business processes and continue to refine and improve the I-forms, as well as e-file and e-pay. And we actually have e-citation, at least for the Oregon State Police. They can, when they issue a citation, it goes right into the system and cuts down on the sort of errors and delays that can result there. So that's going to be in our POP 404. Best practices, I talked about crew a little bit. We are also trying to improve the jury experience. Now with Odyssey, there is a component that allows us to send out the jury summonses, handle check-in, jury questionnaires, through our Odyssey system. We are working on expanding and solidifying funding for our specialized courts and dockets, which we've talked about a couple times. Let me close by mentioning the key performance measures. This is, again, something the legislature asked us to work on and asked all agencies to identify. I'm not going to go through these. These are the key performance measures that are on the slide 34 are ones that were adopted in 2003. With the capabilities that we'll have with Odyssey, we felt it was time to look at these again, to update them, to try and tie them better to some national standards, and to try and measure important outcomes rather than you know, how much time did we spend on something? What's really at stake here? And we have updated some of these eight measures, key performance measures, and we have swapped out some for others that seem more relevant to the kind of work we do now and to the national standards, which will allow us to compare what we do to what other states are doing. And the slide 36, which is the last slide that that I'm going to have this afternoon, are our new key performance measures. I don't think we have time to talk about all of them now, but you might look at these, and if there are if you have suggestions about these, let us know. But we have not done consumer surveys in the past. I think for things like access and how we treat those who come to the courts in terms of fairness, in terms of equality and respect, those are very subjective things. That doesn't mean they're not important to measure. And we're going to be surveying on those things. We are concerned, as all courts should be, about time to disposition. In the foster care area, we're worried about time to the first permanency hearing. That's not the only thing you could measure, but how quickly can we sort of move kids appropriately? We don't want to jump to conclusions. On the other hand, we also don't want juveniles to languish in the system. Again, one of the major issues for all of us, and I think for the whole community, is recidivism. And we have a new measure and from the Criminal Justice Commission of recidivism, which we're going to be tracking to help us figure out whether what we're doing is actually helping reduce recidivism. That is really the name of the game in terms of our criminal justice system. So with that, I'd like to close just by saying that I feel very fortunate to be able to work with Ms. Click and with the other people in the Oregon Judicial Department. What we do is very important to the people of this state. We need to do it fairly. We need to appropriately apply the laws that that you enact. And protect the constitutional rights that are the founders set out for us. We do that every day. We remember that whether it's a very big case involving corporations or aggravated murder, or it's a very small claims court case involving neighbors or a landlord-tenant dispute, that the cases are important to the litigants, and our fair and appropriate handling of those cases is important to the state of Oregon and to fulfilling that constitutional promise to have a court system that administers justice openly, completely, and without delay. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions, and Ms. Click is as well.
Are there any questions? Excellent. Thank you, and wow, you're very punctual. And earlier when you mentioned trying not to bid against yourself on judges, I'm assuming that later on in this presentation when you talk about the POPs, you would discuss which three would be your priority and why and so forth as well?
Yes, we will do that.
Excellent. To be continued tomorrow. Thank you, everyone. We are adjourned.